Chapter 1973, Kurt Flood 2, Dave McNally. The game, Baltimore Orioles 10, Milwaukee Brewers nothing at Memorial Stadium, Baltimore, Maryland. Attendance, 26,543. On Friday, April 6th, 1973, the weather was sunny and 60s. Hall of Famers, Orioles manager Earl Weaver, pitcher Jim Palmer, and third baseman Brooks Robinson. Game highlights. As a result of the Senators' move to Texas, the American League executed a one-for-one swap of two of baseball's perennial cellar dwellers, with the Senators' Rangers franchise moving from the AL East division to the AL West, while the Milwaukee Brewers joined the powerhouse Baltimore Orioles in the AL East. Beginning only their fifth season since being part of baseball's 1969 expansion, the Brew Crew was humiliated on opening day 1973. Baltimore's Don Baylor, who had taken over the outfield spot vacated a year earlier by Frank Robinson, went 4-for-4, drove in 4 runs, scored twice, and homered. Dave McNally went the distance and gave up only 3 hits for Baltimore. The story. For the first time, fans found letters they'd never seen before in the box score. D.H. It stood for Designated Hitter, players who would bat for the notoriously weak hitting pitchers. The rule change adopted by the American League after decades of discussion and debate added more offense to the game and took away the bat from the Orioles' 1973 opening day starter, Dave McNally, one of only 2 pitchers with 2 career World Series home runs. Bob Gibson was the other. McNally sat on the bench throughout Baltimore's at-bats, watching Terry Crowley go 2-for-4 in his spot. If Kurt Flood had been Marvin Miller's willing pawn in the MLBPA's first move toward free agency, then McNally was one of the 2 all-important bishops. Over his 13-year career in Baltimore, he'd earned the reputation as one of the American League's most consistent and dominant pitchers, but it was his performance off the field in late 1975 that earned him a spot on the Mount Rushmore of baseball free agency, right there with Flood, Miller, and his fellow chess piece, Andy Messersmith. McNally had posted an 87-31 record from 1968 to 71 and was rewarded with a $105,000 contract for 1972, making him the first American League pitcher ever in the $100,000 club, a magic number in those pre-free agency days. "He's worth every cent," Orioles pitching coach George Bamberger told Phil Jackman, writer for the Sporting News and Baltimore's Evening Sun. "Nobody in baseball has worked as hard as he has. He never pouts or moans, no matter how he's hurting." McNally accumulated his strong work ethic and moral compass growing up in Billings, Montana. His father was killed serving in World War II when Dave was only 2 years old. His mother raised 4 children on her own, and everyone had to pitch in. McNally was only 17 when he signed with Baltimore for $80,000 in 1960. A year later, he married Jean Hoffer, his sweetheart from Billings Central Catholic High School. They settled in Baltimore, where they raised their 5 children. As popular as McNally may have been with fans, coaches, and teammates, he was strongly disliked by management. Not only was he the team's player rep with the union, but he was one of the first players to hire an agent to negotiate his contract, considered an affront by ownership. In John Eisenberg's 2002 book on the Orioles' history, From 33rd Street to Camden Yards, Orioles general manager Frank Cashin described McNally as a tough son of a bitch. Intractable is a good word for him. After the 1974 season, the winningest pitcher in Orioles' history asked to be traded. "I haven't been pitching the way I'm capable," McNally told Doug Brown of the Sporting News. "And maybe a trade would wake me up." Some speculated his contentious contract talks in recent years or rumored difficulties with Earl Weaver also played a part in his decision. In December, his wish was granted. Along with outfielder Rich Coggins, he was traded to the Montreal Expos for outfielder Ken Singleton and pitcher Mike Torres. McNally never agreed to terms with his new team, so the Expos invoked the reserve clause and gave McNally notice they had renewed his 1974 contract. As a union leader, McNally knew what Miller needed to mount a legal challenge to the reserve clause. Paragraph 10A of the uniform player's contract said, in part, that if the player and his team had not reached a new agreement by March 1 each year, then the team, quote, shall have the right by written notice to the player to renew this contract for the period of 1 year on the same terms, unquote. With binding arbitration now in hand from the April 1972 strike settlement, Miller and MLBPA General Counsel Dick Moss needed at least one player to play 1 year without signing a contract. The union would offer the arbitrator an alternative interpretation to the reserve clause, that a team's right to automatically renew a player's contract was not in perpetuity, but rather lasted only 1 year. In McNally and Messersmith, Miller had found his bishops, two players who played the 1975 season under the owner-invoked renewed terms of their 1974 contracts. On the field, McNally's 1975 season with the Expos was disappointing and brief. After 14 seasons in the major leagues, he announced his retirement just 2 months into the season. "I got to the point where I was stealing money," McNally told Ian McDonald of the Gazette in Montreal, echoing the same sentiments he'd expressed just a few months earlier in Baltimore. "I was trying to tell myself it would come around. If I had arm trouble or any kind of arm injury, then I could say I had an excuse. There's absolutely nothing wrong with my arm." His playing days were over, but he never signed the formal retirement papers. In the months that followed, this would prove to be important. In June, he walked away from the remainder of his $115,000 salary and began planning to move his family from Baltimore back to Billings. The owners weren't done with their maneuvering, trying to outflank Miller and Moss. If they could somehow get the two players off the grievance for the arbitration hearing, they could at least buy themselves another year of controlling the players. They hoped the Los Angeles Dodgers could work out a deal before the late November hearing with their star pitcher Messersmith, just as the San Diego Padres had done a year earlier with outfielder Bobby Tolan. But what to do about McNally? In November 2000, ESPN.com's Darren Revell wrote a retrospective on the infamous 1975 arbitration process. 25 years ago, on a cold and early November, Montreal Expos president John McHale called Dave McNally to tell the former Orioles great that he just happened to be in Billings, Montana. McHale invited McNally, who lived just minutes away, to stop by and have some lunch. "Yeah, passing through Billings, Montana in November," laughed Dick Moss. Revell continued, "McNally had an offer to make for his apparently useless pitcher. He offered McNally a $25,000 signing bonus and $125,000 if he made the team in 1976. The four-time 20-game winner had never seen a paycheck that big before. And that wasn't all. The Expos were going to pay his family's expenses in Florida in the wintertime, and no matter how spring training turned out, he would get to keep the $25,000, said Miller. Like Flood, McNally had a selfless streak. He understood the greater good for future players. He declined McHale's attempted bribe, and the hearing proceeded later that month. On December 23, 1975, arbitrator Peter Seitz ruled in favor of the two pitchers, effectively ending the reserve clause for labor matters and changing the business of professional sports forever. And like Flood, McNally never saw a dime of the game's newfound riches. For the box score, play-by-play, Dave McNally's bio from Sabre.org, and more, visit openingday5050.com.